Okay. So I wanted to do the history of American food because, as you all know, I just finished a history class and I'm kind of getting into like a history buff now. So that was something that's interested me. And this interest actually started a few years ago when I was approached at the grocery store by a man when I was looking at the cheese slices, American cheese slices. And he actually warned me not to buy those because he used to work at a factory that made the cheese slices and that what goes in there is so disgusting that you just don't even want to know what is in there. It's not even food. So that always stayed with me. Like, I always kind of wondered, like, how we came from, you know, the very basic foods that grow here to eating something that's not even food. So that's how we start. So, by 1776, which is when most people consider the beginning of America, settlers had already been in the New World here for over 150 years and sort of started to redefine what American food is even at that time. Because when they came over, food from England just did not exist here in the United States. And a lot of the colonists refused to eat the foods that were native here. So the history of American food actually begins with the Indians. And at the time that Columbus came over, the Indians were using over 2,000 foods that grew here and that were derived from plants. And among those were potato, which was unknown at all in Europe, sunflower, onion, many, many different roots, which they used, to, depending on the consistency, some they used to make breads with and different things, nuts, and they also had, of course, plenty of game animals that lived around here, including like elk and deer and buffalo, of course, but they also ate small animals like squirrel, rabbits, goat, and ocean animals like frogs, turtles, every fish you could think of. And so they had a very well-balanced diet. Diseases like scurvy just did not exist at all to the Indians, which they did to the Europeans. Indians taught the Europeans about farming and about how to plant, how to use fertilizer. A lot of them used fish. They planted fish along with their seeds as a fertilizer, and that helped them grow better. And the colonists were actually very slow to catch on as to how farming actually worked. They were used to growing wheat, which apparently you just scatter on the ground. Well, corn, which is what was native here, is you have to actually plant it. And so they actually had many failed crops before they caught on about that. The Indians also taught them how to cook a little bit, how to steam lobster, how to cook salmon, how to dry meat to make jerky, and their sweetener that they used, because sugar was not available yet, was imported, but it was very expensive. And so the sweetener mostly was wild bee honey and also maple sugar, which they got in the wintertime, and that was native to the New World. And I read that, I mean, that Americans just really took to that maple sugar and they ate like 40 times, you know, the amount that we eat now. But of course, we eat a lot more just raw sugar now. So I'm sure it's kind of the same. This I thought was interesting. Coconuts arrived in Florida. They were not native here, but they arrived in Florida after a shipwreck happened off the coast of Florida that was bringing the cargo from the West Indies, and those coconuts just took root and started growing there in Florida, and that's how they came here. The Spanish brought oranges to Florida, and that almost was to combat scurvy as well. They had kind of figured out that oranges would help, and so it was when the ships came into dock in Florida, the men were supposed to immediately go out and start eating those oranges to combat the disease, because they'd been on the ships for a lot of times many months. But these were not the sweet oranges that we eat today. They are actually very sour. But they did the job. Melons came over from Africa. Slaves brought the seeds over, and that's how they made their way into this country. And this was interesting that Texas had buffaloes here already, but the cattle came later because they had escaped from herds that the conquistadors had brought over, and their descendants were the Texas Longhorns. Pilgrims learned to hunt from the Indians too, but they were kind of lazy, and they imported pigs and chickens over here. They were very easy to bring over, and they were very easy to kill. So they didn't have to do the work that the Indians did. So pork was actually their meat of choice for over 3 centuries, eating pork almost every day. Our eating of potato and tomato, we contribute to Thomas Jefferson. No one ever ate in this country before Thomas Jefferson, no one ate potatoes or tomatoes because they thought they were poison. And Thomas Jefferson was actually a botanist and a very avid gardener. And potato came first, and he grew those in his garden and convinced people to give it a try, which very slowly they did, but they first had to boil it, and then they considered the water that it was boiled in to be poison, that the water boiling took out the poison, but then it was in the water, and you were not supposed to do anything with that water except for throw it out very carefully, you know, don't let anybody hear it. And so finally it was almost these things had to be imported to Europe, accepted over there, and then back here before people accepted them here in the United States, and that's what happened. And the same thing with tomato. They thought that caused cholera and some other diseases, and it wasn't until it was really accepted in other countries that it was then accepted here, even though it was native to here. So that's very interesting. So during all this time, foods are actually kind of being sent back and forth. Foods from the old world are sent to the new and so forth. And the Indians really loved the European fruits that were sent over here, especially the peaches. After those took root here from Europe, you really couldn't find an Indian tribe that lived in a good area where peaches grew, you know, that just did not have growth of peaches. Also apricots, pears, and apples were brought over here. And wheat and rye was brought also by the Europeans, but the Indians really did not have any use for that because they were used to corn. They already had corn meal. Livestock was also brought over at that time with the pigs and cattle as well. And they also brought in the iron kettle, which changed the way cooking was done. Food wasn't just thrown in the fire. You could do different dishes now that you had this iron kettle. So the colonists, when they had come over, because they were so weary of plant life, they'd just never seen the plants that grow here, the native things. You know, fish was pretty much the same. Apparently the game that they saw here was not things that they'd seen before, but was close enough that they did eat a little bit of that. But they were so weary of the plant life that most of the colonists just ate meat. They just lived mostly on meat. So in the 17th century, the colonies became more established, and their cooking changed a little bit. Women were cooking over an open fire. There wasn't stoves yet, but they did have kettles. And later, they had frying pans. There was no glass, even though glass existed. It was had to be imported, and it was not really readily available. So bowls and things were made out of wood. Of course, they had no running water. But most farms had a pump or a well, and those in the more urbanized places wells actually became polluted quite often, so it was actually better if you lived in a more isolated area. Restaurants did not exist, but taverns were opened in around the 1640s in Massachusetts, and they were just mostly for men, for drinking. They did serve food, but it wasn't very good, I guess. And the colonists actually did not see the point of farming. They didn't want to farm because animals were so plentiful, and they did have their own, most had their own stock of pigs, so, and chickens. The revolution and the wars brought in some of the immigrants from France and Germany, and that did have an influence a little bit on the cooking, but it was mostly concentrated in certain areas, like Germantown, you know, in Louisiana, that's where you get some of the French cooking, but it just stayed really in those areas. When visitors would come from other countries, they were shocked at American food. They didn't like it. It was a lot of times poor quality, and many stated that the diet was unhealthy, sure to destroy teeth, stomach, and health. But no one ever said that Americans didn't get enough food. Everyone said who came from other countries said that we ate too much meat, which actually, the United States still is number one in meat eating. And the meat that they ate the most of was the salted pork. And when you hear the expression scraping the bottom of the barrel, they're actually talking about the salt pork barrel. And even poor people could afford this meat, where in Europe, Europe food is like synonymous with bread. You know, everybody has like bread and maybe a vegetable or something on the side, but meat is something that only the wealthy people had, and of course in this country even poor people could have the salt pork every single day. And the other comment is that in like the Indian cooking and other countries, you know, anything that can be saved and used is in cooking, and in American cooking, everything that can be thrown away is thrown away. So everything was very abundant in this country. Early cookbooks, which were written in the first two-thirds of the 19th century, really show us like what kind of foods people were eating. And these cookbooks just freely call for mussels and oysters. And like mussels especially are something that, you know, we just wouldn't, a lot of people just don't even consider eating today. And also a lot of game, turtle, things that, you know, just are not as common. And spices, of course, were very important because this was before refrigeration, and so food spoiled quite often and we still ate it, but not spice covering it up. So everything is very abundant in the books. Oysters are called for by the hundreds, you know, to go into a soup. You know, you need to have like 200 oysters for a soup. One bean soup called for 6 pounds of beef to like start it up. One simple clear gravy soup called for 3 pounds of beef, 3 pounds of veal, a half a pound of ham that went into there. A cake recipe called for 90 eggs. Of course, that was a wedding cake. A regular cake called for 20, and it had instructions for the cook to beat vigorously for 3 hours. So, and these cookbooks just take for granted that everyone lives on a farm and that everyone grows their own food. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm sure you'd have to save up for something like that. But yes, and that everybody has all the time in the world, apparently, if they can beat,
have a heart attack, but yeah.
Beat vigorously for 3 hours.
The other 8 to 12 kids would help out.
So, this was before refrigeration, before that food spoiled so easily. Thing I had read that, especially in the South where the weather was a lot hotter, that just everything was sour and you just got used to it. They had sour bread with sour butter on it and sour milk to drink. I mean, even just at right after you milked the cow, it was sour just within a couple of hours. So that was just something that people had gotten used to. But the very rich people had ice houses, which is kind of like a shed, you know, that they filled with this ice that came from frozen rivers and lakes and things. But that was very hard to maintain. The ice didn't even last that long. And so later, the ice box was invented, which was more like a little cabinet that everybody could pretty much could afford. And so the ice went on top, and it had a little drip tray, and then the bottom is where the food went, and that really helped considerably. And so the iceman would come around the neighborhood, and you would have a little card that you'd put in your window, a little square card, and you'd put a number as to how many blocks of ice you wanted, and he could deliver that. So that helped until we got the refrigeration that we have now, which actually didn't come until us almost a century later. So the other thing that helped boost cooking and food as we know it is transportation. Most importantly, steamboats were invented and the Erie Canal was built, and those things helped transport food that were never available in other parts of the country, you know, to get where they were going. That speeded that up, and because the transportation was then cheaper, the cost of food went down. So flour, which before this, before the Erie Canal, was $16 a barrel, it dropped to $4 a barrel. And so just many different items were shipped, which just all in all lowered the price of food. And 1 year after the Erie Canal was built, the railroad started their business, and within 25 years they had actually put the canal out of business for shipping food. And the railroad expanded the types of food that were available as well as the quality, because they said that now the meat was better because the cows, pork, that kind of thing, they actually rode to where they were going instead of walking. So the meat actually was better. Not as tough, and
where's PETA when you
milk consumption increased due to this because it wasn't spoiling as often. They were able to refrigerate some of the cars, you know, with ice. So the beginning of food processing was these housewives basically that were doing what they called canning, but was actually bottling, to preserve fruits and vegetables so they could eat them out of season. And they would just spend, if a fruit came in, new fruit or vegetable came in, they would just buy huge quantities of it or collect, you know, pick whatever huge quantities and then spend the day jarring them, you know, and preserving them. And these would actually last, if it was done properly, it would last a year or more, and they could have it over the winter, and then even the next winter if they didn't have a good crop or things like that. In 1809, vacuum packed jars were invented, which helped preserve things there. And in 1825 was the first patent on the tin can, and that helped the tin. Cans helped during the war, the Civil War, and helped in the California Gold Rush. So a lot of the travelers that went over to California brought those tin cans with them, and they actually said at the time, towards the end of the Gold Rush, that the ground was just littered with the cans and bottles and things like that, and it it just really wasn't an issue at the time. That was the first of the littering. So there was a man by the name of Gale Borden, who in 1846 was inspired by the story of the Donner Party, which is very popular in California history. So that's a story about 87 immigrants who were on their way to California, actually got trapped in the snow on their way because the passageway was blocked by snow. And 47 of these in the party were actually able to survive by eating their loved ones who had died, so they had to resort to cannibalism. So Borden was very upset and touched by this story, and he tried to concentrate foods that could be used by travelers. He said he wanted to invent a potato that could fit in the pillbox, or a pumpkin that could fit in a teaspoon. And he wanted to invent something like this so that travelers could easily pack the food, and that would never happen again because they would just have all this food. So he spent 6 years trying to miniaturize food, and he developed a meat biscuit, which there was like some sort of hiking party that they used this Borden biscuit. Mm-hmm. But as for like the day-to-day people at home, nobody really cared because meat is so abundant. Anyway, no one cared about this mini biscuit. So he focused his efforts on milk and created condensed milk. And that was in 1856, so 10 years later. And this condensed milk was used in the Civil War, and it made him famous and it made him rich. And Borden had a son fighting on two sons. One fought on each side. One actually fought for the Union and one fought for the Confederacy. And so he actually, you know, could have marketed it on both sides, marketed his product. But he didn't have to because the government had commandeered his plant. So he, but he was paid very well for that service. And so it was just the Union soldiers that drank the condensed milk, and they really liked it. And he also made condensed blackberry juice using his same equipment. And the Union soldiers liked it so much that they wanted it after the war was over, and thereby introducing that to their friends and family. And so now that's the Borden's milk. That's who that is. So during the Civil War, the canning industry just exploded, and many foods became available that were never available before, including perishables such as fish. Salmon and things like that were actually able to be packed in cans. And there was a lot of steps towards improving the canning process, making the cans better, making them sealed better, making it easier to fit the top and bottom on. And so that just really pushed us forward there. And so then after the war, the nation moved towards more industrialization, more urbanization. The soldiers returned home still wanting to eat the same out-of-season, unspoiled foods that they had eaten in the service. They'd been in there for actually many years. And so that's the people on the farms, the housewives, actually moved more towards growing less of their own food and buying more of it because it was available at a fair price. And taste was not really a factor because in those areas where the food did not exist before, they really hadn't tasted the fresh product versus the canned, so taste didn't matter. So in the north, they got pineapple and grapefruit, and those that were inland finally got to enjoy seafood. And so that was a step that they took, that you just can go back once you had these things. And in 1897, there was a chemist named John Dorrance, whose family owned a cannery in New Jersey. And he was interested in trying to diversify the products that they sold. And so he began experimenting with concentrated soups. So a year later, he and his family were able to put on the market canned consomme, vegetable, tomato, and chicken soup, and that was the beginning of the Campbell's enterprise. And at that same time, a young man in Sharpsburg, Pennsylvania, raised horseradish in his backyard, and he began bottling that and selling it to stores in the area, and the grocers liked that. And so then he began bottling pickles and ketchup and relish until his offerings numbered 47 varieties. I mean, 57 varieties. Uh-huh. And that was Henry J. Hines. And then one more story. Same time, a grocer in Chicago saw that people got their cheese at that time by actually they'd go to the store and just slice off a hunk of cheese from like a really big cheese that just sat on the counter at the grocery store. And so he wanted to provide housewives with something more sanitary and more reasonably sized and individually wrapped. And so he began making his own cheese and wrapping the wedges in tin foil, and he got a horse and buggy and he started driving the streets selling the cheese door to door, and his name was J.H. Kraft. So the same man that made that processed cheese, although I'm sure the processed cheese food came after his time, that's where that came from. And so I'm actually going to stop there with the history, because it just kind of goes from there with all the products that we already have heard of and the commercialization just went on from there. And when I was doing my research, I just thought these were interesting little tidbits that the foods that we most consider to be American food, like hamburgers, actually, of course, did not come from America, but rather from Hamburg, Germany. That's where that started, and then it sort of evolved to the little patty that we eat now. Apple pie, neither apples nor pie, come from this country. They were imported from England, and also Dutch did that. But the other foods that I wouldn't have considered to be something from America actually are, and those include jambalaya and gumbo. Those were actually created here in the Louisiana area, but they're not eaten anywhere else. Fortune cookies are an American product, which I'm very surprised to learn that they're actually unheard of in China. And they were just introduced apparently in the late 90s, and they're called over there American fortune cookies. So that was a product of America, which I had no idea. And the last one I'm going to say is fudge, which was made almost 100 years ago, which just came from the United States. And it was actually supposed to be a batch of caramels that got messed up, and that's why they call it fudge. But we have an old recipe in our family, and when I was several years ago, I inherited some of my great-grandmother's diaries as a girl, and she writes many times in there about making fudge, and so I've got some today. My grandma's recipe.
100-year-old recipe.
100-year-old recipe. So, anyone
want
to try
walk around?
And then, you know, if you have any questions.
Well, thank you. That was very interesting.